I was born Ernest James Duke. For the last decade plus of my life, my friends, family, and loved ones have come to know me as Ernesto. I was born in SoCal. I grew up in NorCal. I met my wife in Baja Cal, and now I live in Los Angeles. For me, the best coast is the West Coast. I serve in a small Latino church. I live in a diverse community, and I have a beautiful blended ethnic family through foster care and adoption. This is the Cultural Christ.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, J.W. Buck. In this podcast, we explore the intersection between the Christian faith and cultural identity. We hold interviews with followers of Jesus to discuss the way our faith impacts our culture and how our cultural identity impacts faith. Now to this week's episode. Welcome, Ernesto. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for being on. So let's hop into cultural identity. Tell me a little bit about your background, your upbringing.
I grew up in a white family in the middle of the forest in Northern California. I was born in Southern California, but my dad had a dream to start a business and to live not in LA. He grew up in LA his whole life. And so moved us to the middle of nowhere in a town with no stoplights, with a few stop signs, a post office, and a liquor store. That's all we had.
So anybody that is on the news on their phone is like, California's always on fire. Was it on fire around you growing up?
Yeah. The part of California that was always on fire was where I lived. Was it uncommon? Well, every once in a while, you would like, there's a swimming hole or like an area that you go fish in that like one bad fire season, the helicopters would come in and take all the water. And then it would take like 2 or 3 years to fill back up. But yeah, you know, like there's like, well, we had snow days, but you know how like in LA, like if it rains or drizzles a little bit, they'll cancel school because they're afraid of the water. So up there, we'd have smoke days, like it'd be too smoky and they're like, you can't go outside, you're all going to die. And so you just wouldn't have school, or you get out early, or like baseball, football games get canceled because of smoke in the air. Yeah, not fun. But our house never got burned down. So
that is good.
Yeah.
Where in Southern California were you born?
I was actually born in Huntington Beach. I was born in Huntington Beach. My dad grew up around that area, bought a house when he was 16 by forging his mom's signature to on the title of the house. And then I lived in that house until I was about 10 or so. And then we moved to Northern California.
Siblings?
Yeah. I have a brother who is a couple years younger than me. He's the smartest person in our family. He's a chemical engineer. He used to make gasoline for the state of California. And now he builds natural gas refineries for the state of California. And then I have a sister who is 9 years younger than me. And her and I, just because of the age gap and because I moved out early, like we didn't spend a lot of time together at home, but we've kind of maintained more of like a long distance friendship sibling thing for a while. And she's awesome. She's the most free spirited of all of us that just breaks every family tradition, cultural norm, whatever we grew up, like she did it, you know, we all did it that way. And she just does something completely different and not like in a rebellious way, but just like her own person. So it's really cool.
What was it like being in a rural area and how that shaped your cultural identity and then your family itself? Like, what were you learning about identity and culture from the rural area and being in your specific family?
So I never knew that I lived in a rural area because, you know, I guess you don't have much to compare it to. But one of the things that I've learned getting married to my wife, who's not from a rural area like that, is there's like different phrases we used growing up. One of them was down the hill, which meant like people come from down the hill. That's down the hill is where you go do like your grocery shopping. You know, like you literally drive down the mountain to go to the town and think like that would be like a deciding factor of the day is like, are we going to go down the hill? Does that friend live down the hill? And then like flatlanders, we used to call people from not the mountains flatlanders, and they just didn't know how to drive in the snow and stuff like that. But to say all that, there's definitely like a pride, maybe healthy, maybe unhealthy, about being like a rural person, I guess. Yeah. Like we chopped our own firewood. All of my friends hunted. My dad didn't hunt because he was like a, you know, surfer from Southern California that moved up there. My high school had a ski snowboard team. My brother like placed in the state championships for the ski team. And I just thought, you know, just like you, like probably kids in Malibu think that every school has a surf team, you know, but like they don't. That's just a normal part of life. I think like for some like church stuff too, like there's this movement that's like on a ballot every other year in California to start something called the State of Jefferson. And the State of Jefferson is trying to basically split off Northern California and some of Southern Oregon into like its own separate state, because there's a lot of the natural resources of our state come from Northern California and Southern Oregon, that type of area. But the vast majority of people live where I live today, which is Los Angeles, or in the Bay Area. And there's just huge ideological differences between those two places. And so there were people in my church. I used to say this guy was an elder at our church, but he was definitely like a looked up to person who was like the president of the State of Jefferson movement or whatever. And so that was like a, we weren't like a real political family, but that was a big thing, was like, those people down there are taking our stuff, our resources. Definitely like a lot of poverty, to be honest. Like you don't live up there in that area unless you are crazy rich, or like you're just, the reason you live in the sticks is because you can barely make your mortgage, and you pretty much, you don't live off the land, but like I said, you're warming your house with trees that fell in your backyard. Yeah. Your kids are going to like the local public school. There's not really a ton of, in when you're younger, like sports and all that kind of stuff isn't really accessible, you know? So yeah, that was, that's like being rural, I guess. I can't even say that word, rural, whatever it is.
Who knows how to say it.
It's a hard word.
Yeah, man. So I was up in Enumclaw, Washington, with a similar experience of up the hill, down the hill, ski culture.
Yeah.
Rural, however you say it. Yeah. And that is a thing.
Yeah.
This dates us. Wasn't there like a Fox show, Over the Hill, about Garland, Texas, or something like that? What was that called?
I believe you. Are you talking about King of the Hill?
King of the Hill. I knew it had to do with to do with the hill.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't allowed to watch that. We could talk about that. I mean, that was some of my religious background, but I knew it existed, and my dad watched it in his room, and every once in a while I'd walk by and laugh at some of the jokes that I could see on the TV. But
yeah,
I was not allowed to watch that show for sure.
So what are some of the values that are instilled in you being in rural California growing up?
It's an interesting question, because I think that, like I said, I moved there when I was 10, and then I left when I was 18. And so I've lived mostly not there, but those are really formative years. I guess I left when I was 19, but those are really formative years of your life. Like all of junior high and high school, and like some elementary, were all in that area. And some of it I've definitely like rebelled against and like pushed away. But I think, you know, some of the values is like a lot of times in like spiritual formation type stuff, there's always like a pathway or something that talks about engaging with creation and God's creation, and like seeing that he's good through how beautiful, you know, the outdoors are and stuff like that. And that's like a language that everyone speaks fluently there, that I've kind of noticed here in LA, like people don't speak that language, right? They just kind of they think it's weird. They think it's weird to spend time outside. And like, why would you want to go camping? Like you could just sleep in your apartment, like that type of thing. Definitely like, I want to say independence a little bit, but like you do have neighbors, but the amount of work that's required from every individual family to just like make it every year, like you can't really help your neighbor cut up wood over the summer for the winter, because your family has to do that all summer long just for your family's wood, right?
Yeah.
But on the other side of it, like my dad was a rural postal carryman. So like he delivered, he knew literally everybody in our entire town, and he had a truck with a winch and four-wheel drive and chains. And so he was constantly getting calls from absolute strangers to go pull people out of ditches or dig them out or whatever. And like, that was just a normal part of our upbringing, is that, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many hitchhikers my dad and I picked up. And like, you know, I think that that's something that now, people who know me know that I have a pretty crappy car. It's not our family car, but it's just my car. And I've over the years let homeless people sleep in it and get out of the rain, and just like random, I leave it unlocked in case somebody wants to sleep in it or whatever. And that is just the value of being up there. Like, you just got to have, you kind of have to look out for each other a little bit. And, you know, the neighborly thing is much, in a weird way, the friendliness to strangers is higher in that environment because of how harsh the conditions are, I think, than what I experience here, where it's not uncommon to see somebody pass out on the side of the street and literally hundreds of people, if not thousands, driving by, walking by, just completely ignoring a human being that's like unconscious, you know, and that would, that wouldn't happen where I grew up.
That is an unbelievable observation. I found that to be true growing up in a rural area as well. I love how you pointed to the conditions being harsher, and acts of kindness in some ways are easier because the conditions are standing against everybody.
Right.
But then there's less people to take care of generally.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's easier to engage. That's really fascinating. I haven't even thought about it like that, but even thinking back on how my parents were in those rural communities and how I was expected to be, you were expected to engage if somebody was having a hard time, no matter who they were.
Right.
That's really cool. Let's transition to what it means to be white for you. This can be an uncomfortable conversation. I know not for you because we're friends, but for some majority culture Christians, we're like most people in the world who have an ethnic background, it's not only a point of pride, but a point of interest and discovery. Yes. And then to be white is like this really nebulous, strange thing in some ways.
Yep.
What did you discover about what it means to be white? Which, by the way, we haven't gotten there yet, but Ernesto lives cross-culturally, speaks Spanish, engages cross-culturally almost every minute of the day in what he does and what he tries to do. So that's an interesting facet that we'll get to. But what does it mean to be white for you?
Yeah. So I've been, people listening don't know this, but you sent me the PDF of what we might talk about like a week ago. And something like clicked in my head, which is that part of what I feel like I miss about being white, like compared to my my neighbors, you know, live right there from El Salvador and Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras. And I'm just, you know, these are just people in our building that we don't have tradition, like we don't have cultural traditions as white people. Some people do. I don't know. Like maybe you eat shrimp on Christmas Eve or something, but that's not what I'm talking about. That's just like something your family does, but like deep rooted cultural shared events, we didn't get any of those, you know? And so like growing up, I just feel like there's a huge disconnection from, that's not a word, disconnect from my ethnic identity as a Sicilian person, a person of Sicilian heritage. And then also just like my whiteness, like in how we lived our life. Some people know this, most people don't, that my name was supposed to be Giovanni Vicente Duke. That was the name that my parents had decided was going to be, and that would have been a very different name than Ernest James Duke, which is what my name is now, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about a hard left turn in naming your child.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's a horrible story of a cousin of mine who passed away at 5 years old or so, and I was named in honor of her dad, who decided not to have children. And so it was like it was a very emotional decision that my dad made in the hospital. But like going into it, that's what my name was supposed to be. My little sister, her name is Giovanna Marie Duke. And that's because like my mom grew up Sicilian or Italian, Sicilian heritage or whatever, and like really connected with that part of her life. Yeah. My grandma's from Switzerland on my dad's side. And he grew up, you know, eating weird sausages and sauerkraut and Swiss German being spoken in the home and things like that. For some reason, when those two cultures got together and then started a family, none of that really got passed on. You know, another part of this was that I think like a lot of white folks, like I didn't realize I was white, you know, like, you know, I've heard from brown and black brothers and sisters that like, you know, you're black, right? You know, you're black when you're a kid, you're somehow, you figure it out pretty early in life that you're a black boy or a black girl or whatever it is. I didn't know I was white. And some of that could be because where I grew up, there just weren't a ton of non-white folks that live there, but that was just my perception. That was my family's perception. I've gone back and like looked at the census data for where I grew up. It's not really true. There was always 30 to 40% non-white people in the areas I was living in. And when I think back to like my high school and junior high, yeah, there were a lot of Latino, mostly Latino folks who lived in that area. It's the last 10 years of my life that I've considered the fact that I'm white. you know. So growing up white, that's almost like, well, what are you talking about? You know, that's not, we didn't do anything because we were white. Nothing.
That's super good. And I think that's a part of the tension is for a lot of us who are white, we might discover it because we're being told we're white.
Yeah.
By people who aren't. So it's like, wait, what? You're telling me I'm this, but what is this and what does it mean? I love how you talked about there are, you know, cultural traditions that your family might have, but not necessarily those traditions related to your ethnicity, where like talk about your neighbors who are Mexican American or El Salvadorian. Those are completely intertwined, at least for some. I don't want to speak for everybody.
Sure. Yeah.
Or for us, it's like, especially if we've been here for 4, 5, 6, 8, 9 generations, whatever.
Yeah.
When I say here, I mean in North America, coming from Europe.
Yeah.
A lot of what it means to be Swiss or Dutch or Sicilian or whatever is like it melted into something new that we call white. And how do we relate to that or define that? That's a challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, I think like a good example of this that people might resonate with is like, you know, ever since I've lived it, well, I lived in Mexico for a little while. And then ever since I've lived here in this neighborhood and or just in the LA area. Well, I'll ask you because you live down here. What do Latino people eat at Christmas time? Do you know what it is? No, Mexican-Americans?
Mexican-Americans.
Yeah. I'm just going to tell you, it's tamales. Like that's tamales, when you, that's like your family gets together, you make tamales and then like everybody has tamales. Right?
I was afraid to give the wrong answer, bro.
That's fine. Yeah. Yeah. My bad. Just fix it in post, you know, whatever.
I'll leave it. You're good.
But like, so let's say that your family grew up eating, you know, doing tamales every single, you know, probably December 22nd or 23rd or whatever. And like your whole family get together. It's an all, I do it every year with my neighbors. Our family does it. It's an entire day event with like 20 people, your lower back hurts. You're like bending over, like doing this really intricate thing the entire time. But if you grew up doing that, you're not the only one doing it. Like this is a cultural tradition that is tied to like, there's hundreds of thousands, millions of people across the world literally doing this right now, because this is what we do. That joke I made earlier, eating shrimp cocktail on Christmas Eve. That's what my family did. We're probably the only ones. I mean, there might be like five other people, you know, but it's like, so for me, that is like a very like intimate tradition thing, because like, that's what my dad wanted it. And that's what we had. It definitely like, it's not connected any deeper than just like that little nuclear family. Like it's important to me. Right. But the roots are so shallow.
That's super helpful. And hopefully those who are listening who come from a majority culture perspective can help reflect also on what does it mean to have an ethnic heritage when, biblically speaking, that's everything.
Right.
Tribe, ethnicity, nation. Mm-hmm. And so what does it look like for Christians to hold that when in some ways that's been lost? Without overemphasizing it, all those things. Okay, let's transition to Jesus. So this podcast, the cultural Christ. For you, describe the intersection between like following Jesus, which we haven't talked about church or faith or like meeting Jesus, and your cultural identity, like who you are as a person.
A part of my story that I didn't really share that much is that whether it was rooted in racism or privilege or naivety or whatever it was, part of what my family was trying to get away from Los Angeles, was the congestion of people. But then it was also my dad, he didn't have super blatant racist opinions about other people, but he definitely was wary of like non-white middle-class folks. And unfortunately, through like confirmation bias and horrible things like that, like I watched horrible things happen to him at the hands of non-white folks. And so that just like ingrained in him over and over and over, like this is a danger. This is something we have to like get away from and watch out for. And so when I was growing up, like that was part of why we moved to where we moved, is like we'd be more isolated. We'd be away from gang activity. We'd be away from, you know, basically, my dad never would have said non-white folks, but he probably felt it. You know, it was probably like a benefit. And the way I know that's true is I remember being in eighth grade and really not liking my teacher, which is really what was happening. But I knew that I could maybe get my dad to get my class changed if I told him, Dad, it's just like there's a bunch of kids in there that don't speak English very well. And like, you know, they're Mexican or whatever. I knew if I brought that up to my dad, that he would go to the office and try and get me put into another class. And so he did. He did try. And then it turned out that there were no non-English speakers in my classes. And so like it was like this embarrassing thing for me and probably for him and all that kind of stuff. And so I stayed in that class. You know, it's a small town, right? So those kids that I was talking about in eighth grade that I had tension with, we all go to high school together. Like we don't, there aren't multiple high schools. You just all go to the same one. And so I had a lot of tension with Latino kids in high school and had some, never like fights or anything like that. And never me being like purposefully racist or something, but just like there were folks I was comfortable with who were white and probably played sports, but not soccer. You know, and then there were folks that I wasn't comfortable with and they were usually Latino. So part of that thing with my dad is like, I would always use his like racism, to, like try and get me out of things. Right. And so, you know, in high school, you have to take languages. I didn't want to take a foreign language just because I didn't want to. It seemed really hard to me. Like I didn't want to take a foreign language. And so my dad and I just decided we weren't going to take one. And then it finally got to like the end of my sophomore year and they're calling home and they're like talking to him and saying, hey, like your son has to take a language next year. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take German, like whatever. And not because of anything, just like, just because I'm going to just take German. Yeah. And then something happened and it's kind of like one of those, like God just must have been working behind the scenes and like nobody really knew what was going on. But for whatever reason, I ended up in a Spanish one class. And I don't know if I chose it or my dad chose it or my mom chose it or the school is like, this family's crazy. We're just going to put this kid in a Spanish one class. And I fell in love with it. Like it was my favorite class. I had no clue how much I was going to like learning Spanish. It immediately became a gateway for friendships and being invited to quinceañeras and over to stay at people's house. And there was a trailer park in our neighborhood where most of the people who worked on like farms and Christmas tree farms and pumpkin farms and stuff like that, they all lived there. And I would go to these parties there with just like hundreds of people and all, you know, all generations are there, little kids all the way up to grandmas and grandpas, bunch of people who are monolingual Spanish speakers. And I'm just practicing and learning and getting better and better and better. And at this time, I'm also kind of getting saved through it. And so it became completely on accident, like how God decided that he was going to reshape my heart to integrate into Latino communities in a way that I don't know that I would have been violently opposed to it when I was younger or something, but it wasn't even on the radar. And it was actually kind of something like I would have, it was not my jam at all. Yeah. But just through like, through some weird academic advisor at my high school and maybe like a wrong registration thing. And then me falling in love with this, you know, with this language and this art and this culture and then making friends. And it was a complete game changer for me.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. How does that map on your faith journey or your understanding of Jesus and Christianity? Because there are certain people that just love engaging cross-culturally or they get a high from like being in a situation that's uncomfortable for them. And they just like love traveling or watching some dumb show on Nat Geo and feeling like they are cultured. You're very different. I mean, you're very different than that, bro.
Yeah.
And who you are and what you do. So talk a little bit about Jesus and faith and how that informs that engagement.
For me, it all kind of came together when I moved to Mexico. And I moved to Mexico because of my dad, actually, very randomly. After I graduated high school, I thought I wanted to be a dual major Spanish-Italian. I would teach Spanish and Italian in high school is what I wanted to do. And he convinced me that I should take like a gap year and I should move somewhere either to Italy or Mexico. And Italy is really far away and expensive and Mexico I could drive to. So I ended up moving to Mexico and I worked in an orphanage there. Anybody who's bilingual and you've thought of if you're this type of weird nerd where you think about like what language means and why syntax is the way it is and stuff, like you realize that like there's a lot of worldview that's expressed in language. And something about learning Spanish, but not just like the vocabulary words, but living at an orphanage where there's hierarchy and power structures and people I'm allowed to talk to and people I'm not supposed to talk to. And then people I have to talk to in a particular like form. And then some people that I can just like mess around with and people were peers and not peers. It helped me realize that however I grew up with my shrimp cocktail on Christmas Eve traditions, there's completely different people groups out there. And they think very, very differently about the world. And like their hearts and their minds are just shaped in a way that's so different than how I grew up. I think that being at the orphanage and being a part of, like, that was another part, is I was, you know, we were part of our local church there. It was a bivocational guy. He wasn't even bivocational. He was an unpaid pastor who, you know, just like faithfully loved and served his community for probably 25 years at that time. His dad had planted the church 40 years prior. They had never been paid. Like, they just live and work in that neighborhood and care for that neighborhood. And to be able to be there and realize, like, it was such like a formational time for me to realize, this happens for anybody, I guess, when they travel or when they meet somebody from outside a different culture. But for me, it was like my entire life just got picked up, and I was in majority culture, and I was, you know, I was white, I was English speaking, I was middle class. And then I got put somewhere where I was a minority, ethnically, my skin pigmentation, my communication ability, my familiarity with the culture and understanding of politics and power dynamics. I lived as a minority in a different country, and it just changed, like, literally, it changes the way that I interact with every one of my neighbors, all of the kids that I coach, you know, like in different rec sports or whatever. Yeah, because it's a completely different experience of life to be in a culture that's not the one you grew up in. And I've gotten more comfortable in Latino culture, but there's still things where I'm reminded that this isn't, you know, this isn't necessarily how I grew up.
Hope you'll join us next week for part two of this interview. Thank you so much for listening. If you want more content, you can go to jwbuck.org or follow me on Instagram, handles jwbuck. If you have any questions about culture, cultural identity, or faith, feel free to send me a message. Hope you'll join us next week.